I'm Holly Smith, a member of the class of 1972, the first class of women to be admitted into the College of Arts and Sciences, and it's my great pleasure to introduce fellow former Cavalier Daily newspaper staffer and 1983 UVA graduate, Cheryl Gay Stolberg. The CD obviously proved to be a great training ground for her because she's been covering the White House for the New York Times for the past 5 years. And in the journalism world, that is regarded as galactic success. She now has a new job with the Times, but I'll let her tell you more about that. She has traveled the world covering two presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and has also been a congressional correspondent for the Times. Prior to covering Congress, she worked as a science correspondent in the Times Washington Bureau, specializing in bioethics and public policy issues, including the global AIDS epidemic, bioterrorism, the quest for an artificial heart, and the fight over embryonic stem cell research. And before joining the Times in 1997, Ms. Stolberg worked at the Providence Journal, which I believe is in Rhode Island, I think, and at Los Angeles Times. And in LA, she shared in two Pulitzer Prizes won by that newspaper staff for coverage of the 1992 riots and the 1994 wildfires. She's also the recipient of the Gerald Loeb Award for Distinguished Financial Journalism for her coverage of President Bush and the mortgage meltdown of 2009. Ms. Stolberg lives in Chevy Chase, Maryland with her husband, the photographer Scott Robinson, their two daughters, Olivia and Hannah, and a big, frisky black dog, Cheryl.
So I have given a lot of policy and political talks over the years, but I wanted to make this talk really a more personal talk about my journey here and as a journalist, and include some of my observations about Washington and our political culture. So I hope you'll indulge me in that. I am an unlikely person to be the White House correspondent for the New York Times. The first time I attended a presidential news conference, I had an imaginary talk with my father. He didn't live to see me get there. It was June 2006. George W. Bush was in office, and my father, Irving Stolberg, had died about 6 months earlier of a terrible cancer. He was very young and very fit when his cancer struck. He was 68. And so there I was in the Rose Garden of the White House, the new White House correspondent for the New York Times, and the president was talking, no doubt about Iraq, because the country was sliding into, that country was sliding into civil war. And I wasn't really listening to him. It was my job to listen and take notes, and there I was telling my father, "Dad, I'm here. I made it." I was the first and it's good that we stopped because I was going to cry. Okay. How about this? I was the first person in my family to go to college. I grew up in a pretty wealthy town, Merrick, New York. It's on Long Island. And it was really a financial reach for my parents to buy a house there. They bought their home because of the good schools, and they also probably bought it for religious reasons. We're Jewish, and Merrick is a town that has four synagogues and one Catholic church. So you can pretty much do the math. My father worked for a company that manufactured printing ink, not the kind that goes into newspapers, but the kind that is on paper and boxes and packaging. And his first job was as a color matcher in the factory. Imagine Clinique makeup and all the beautiful shades, the pastels and rose, and imagine them having to match all the colors of their lipstick to colors on the box. That's what he did. He would come home at night with ink under his fingernails. He worked for that company for 50 years. Ultimately, he retired as a vice president of sales. My mother was a self-taught bookkeeper. Her own father died when she was 17, and by the time she was 18, she was married to my father. They were so young that on their wedding night, when they went to the hotel, the clerk accused them of shacking up. My grandmother, my father's mother, had to sign the marriage license because he was 20, and in New York, the legal age for a man to marry was 21. My mother had gotten accepted into Hunter College in New York, and she would have gone to become a teacher. But she told me that she didn't want to be more educated than her husband. And to me, my mother's story really is so emblematic of so many women of her generation, women who were smart and capable, but who didn't have the opportunity that I did and that my daughters will. And today, just as an aside, I would say that my mother is one of the most culturally sophisticated people I know. I call her the Full Employment Act for the Arts in New York. There's nary a Broadway play or an opera or a museum opening that she doesn't see. When I called her yesterday, she's been a widow now for 5 years, I called her and she said, "Oh, I'm on the train into the city. We're going to the Philharmonic." But back when I was applying for college, really I had no institutional memory in my family to rely on to help me. Other kids in my town had friends who were in high places. I remember one who had a friend who was a federal judge who wrote a recommendation for her. She wound up going to Princeton. I didn't really know what to do. My applications were all over the map. Big schools, small schools, universities, colleges. There was really no rhyme or reason. But fortunately, I had a very good guidance counselor. And when the yays and nays rolled in that spring, I got thick packets from UVA and also from Cornell. And I really, really wanted to go to Cornell. My parents said they would do it, but it would be a financial reach for them. UVA at the time was less than half the price, even for an out-of-state student. And my mother tells me that I told them that I didn't want to be a burden on them. But I honestly do not remember that conversation. What I remember is my guidance counselor telling me, very wisely in retrospect, if you go to Cornell, you'll be surrounded by a lot of people just like you. And if you go to UVA, you'll experience something different. Well, that was an understatement. So I arrived in Charlottesville in the fall of 1979 like a visitor from another planet. Okay, there were plenty of women. It was 1979, only 8 years after after we went co-ed. But it wasn't the lack of women that struck me. Frankly, it was the lack of black people. And I didn't grow up in a racially integrated town at all, but there were black people here, and they were isolated, it seemed to me. And that was one thing that that bothered me. As for the white people, they were all blonde and beautiful. Everyone, it seemed to me, was, you know, more gorgeous than the next. On the streets, I would walk down the street. You know, in New York, you walk down the street, nobody looks at anybody else. You just keep walking. Here in Charlottesville, people would smile and say hello. And I would think, what do they want? Why are they smiling at me? What did I do something? And I had never seen a preppy before. My parents and I walked down to the corner. My father used to jokingly refer to Mincer's Pipe Shop. He loved to call it Mincer's Pipe Shop. Pincer's Mipe Shop, just as a joke. But so we walked down to the corner. We went into El Joe's. Who remembers El Joe's? Everybody, right? We went in there. First of all, it was like a sea of pink and green. And there were all these wide whale corduroys. There were belts with turtles and whales on them. And the pants were green or plaid. And it was expensive. And I remember looking at my mom and saying, we wouldn't buy this on Macy's bargain basement rack. Like, why are people paying all this money for all these clothes? And remember the preppy handbook? Does anyone remember the Okay, literally, that was supposed to be a spoof, right? That was my survival guide at UVA. That was how I understood UVA culture. So at my dorm, my new roommate, Colleen Murphy from Little Rock, Arkansas, was waiting for me. It was, I swear, 1,000 degrees that August. Colleen was sitting in a chair with her hands clasped and a full length, you know, long sleeve shirt with all the way up to the neck, just waiting, the most prim and proper person you could imagine. Down the hall in the old dorms, you remember how they had those deep window sills? Mary Cobb was there drinking a beer. I'm telling you, I hope Mary's mother is not here. I know Mary's not here because she's still my friend, and so is Colleen. But I had never seen a girl drink a beer before. And they are still my friends, both of these women. But back then, I could not imagine for the life of me what I had in common with any of them or really anybody else here. And we had a dorm meeting that fall. At our dorm meeting, a young man from Birmingham, Alabama, I'll call him John C., said to me, "Is it true that Jews live in ghettos?" And I want to tell you, he was not being mean. He was not. He was like me. He was in a place that was different, and he was meeting people who were different, and he just wanted to know. Now, I was out of sorts that whole first semester. I came home for Thanksgiving. My parents did not know what to do with me. I wasn't my old self anymore. I didn't fit in at home. I really didn't fit in at school. Sororities weren't appealing to me. I was trying out new things, sort of changing my clothes and my style. I tried those Fair Isle sweaters. You know, I think, I don't know. You know, and I remember I must have been taking a religion class, and someone saw a Bible on my desk, and a New Testament. And a comment got back to me that someone said, "Oh, is she going to change that too?" And I've never forgotten that. It's painful for me to remember that, but it is sort of emblematic, I think, of the wrestling that I went through when I first came here. And I gave a lot of thought to transferring, but I did stick it out. Ultimately, I found my place at the Cavalier Daily. I grew to love this university. I lived on the lawn my fourth year here, and I wouldn't be here if I hadn't found a way to love the place. And I gave a talk at the Cavalier Daily this morning. We're doing a media seminar in Washington soon for UVA graduates. So I do love this place. And I think we can stipulate that I learned to be a journalist here and that I got a very fine education here. But I think that my life here in Charlottesville really left me with something else. It sort of taught me the greatest lesson that I think anyone can learn, and that is flexibility and the importance of being able to adapt. Here is where I learned the value of interpersonal diplomacy. I learned to respect tradition. We love tradition, right? Not to revere it at all costs, and sometimes to question it, but also to respect it. I learned how to appreciate and understand cultures that were different from my own. And I learned to confront my own prejudices, because truth be told, I had them. I was somewhat intolerant and maybe even a little suspicious of Southerners. Being here smashed some stereotypes for me. And I feel that in a deeply important way, being here softened me. And these are all lessons that have been extremely critical to my life as a journalist and my time in Washington. I left Charlottesville in 1983 to pursue my career as a reporter, and some 20 years later, in 2002, I reinvented myself as a journalist. As Holly mentioned, I left being a science writer to cover Congress. My mother said, "Oh, honey, that'll be nice. You'll use your government degree." my arrival on Capitol Hill was its own form of culture shock. I had been a science writer for the Times, and all these doctors and scientists would eagerly return my calls because, of course, they all wanted to get quoted in the New York Times. And we would have these in-depth discussions about bioethics and all kinds of fascinating topics. And now here I was suddenly in the hallways of the Capitol with a tape recorder in my hand running after senators and members of Congress for quotes. I remember an editor telling me, "Oh, you'll have to go to the Tuesday lunches." Well, if anybody has worked on Capitol Hill, they know that the senators have policy luncheons on Tuesdays, the Democrats in one room and the Republicans in another. So I envision myself, you know, snacking on watercress sandwiches with John McCain or John Warner or Teddy Kennedy. And, you know, in reality, I found myself stuck behind a velvet rope with a little tape recorder in my hand, waiting for the senators to come out from behind closed doors. I learned early on a few tricks. Number one is when you cover Congress, you need to collar lawmakers. There are some great places in the Capitol where you can sort of hang out. One is down in the basement subways that connect the office buildings to the Capitol. If you wait there when the senators or the congressmen are having votes, you can pick them off one by one for interviews. The other thing I learned was that if you stick your foot in the senator's only elevator, most of them are too polite to turn you away, and they will invite you in, and then they are trapped in there with you. And in fact, most of them do want to talk. Has anybody here worked on Capitol Hill? Anybody? A few. So you know that, you know, Capitol Hill and Congress is kind of a lot like college. They finish their work at the last minute. They end, you know, just before Christmas or summer break with an all-night pizza party and, you know, votes that last until 3 in the morning. And it really is a never-ending study in human behavior and interpersonal relations. And one thing I always loved when I was there was watching the senators in the chamber for a vote. Our desks are in the Senate press gallery, which is this tiny little space on the third floor of the Capitol, and it overlooks the chamber. And you could go in there and see, you know, who was slapping whose back and who was elbowing who and who was bending whose ear and who was turning their back to who. And everybody there has a fascinating story. All the lawmakers, to me, are so interesting. I think of Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, whose parents died when he was young and who raised his younger sister. Olympia Snow was an orphan at age 9, and so many other interesting people who come from all over the country to serve our country. Now, one of the first stories I wrote as a congressional correspondent was about Trent Lott. It was 2002, and he had just lost his job as majority leader. Many of you may remember he made some racially charged remarks that got him in trouble. And so I was to travel to Mississippi to attend a roast for him, which was kind of his coming out. And I got there, and it was very awkward for him because he had been kind of underground for a while. And I remember him saying to his audience, how can they roast toast? Meaning himself. So this was a very awkward affair for him, but it was a lot more awkward for me. And suddenly there I was, back in Charlottesville, 1979, the Jewish girl from Long Island, you know, sticking out like a sore thumb. You can imagine how I felt when he turned to the crowd in the room and he said, "Ann, we have the New York Times here with us tonight. Welcome, Cheryl." You know, all these heads turned, and, you know, there I was, like, wanting to crawl under the table and remembering John C. And I made it through that night, and I talked to people, and you know what? People were really nice to me. They wanted to know about me as much as I wanted to know about them. And on my way back, the East Coast was socked with snow, and I got trapped in Charlotte, North Carolina, for about 3 days. And I filed my story when I got home, and it talked about how difficult life had been for Trent Lott to go from being leader to the junior senator of Mississippi. His own colleagues didn't know what to say to him. People were uneasy around him. I think I described him as the man nobody wants to mention but whom everybody knows is there. Well, suffice it to say, the senator let me know he was there. He would gleefully tell my colleagues from other newspapers about how I'd gotten stuck on my way home from Mississippi, knowing that they would then share his glee with me. And he ignored me for about 4 months. We would pass in the hallways, and he would not even look at me. And then one day, I was walking in a hallway of the Capitol, and Trent Lott walked by, and he slapped me on the back, and he said, "Hey, welcome back." And I thought, well, I'm not sure if he means welcome back from Mississippi, which was 4 months ago, or welcome back into my fold. But either way, my penance was over, and I must say that I interview Trent Lott all the time now. We have a great relationship. He's no longer a senator. I find him a wise person to talk to about the ways of the Republican Party and various issues. He taught me the same lesson that I think he himself learned in Washington, an important lesson for a journalist to learn, which is don't confuse your colleagues, or in this case, my case, my sources, with friends. Remember who your friends are and who you work with. In 2006, I moved to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and needless to say, covering the Bush administration for the New York Times posed a bit of a challenge. There was already bad blood between the White House and my newspaper when I arrived. The president and his advisors were furious with us for reporting on the secret wiretapping program that they had approved to monitor the conversations of suspected terrorists. Many Republicans thought that that was treason. Some thought we should be prosecuted for treason, for revealing a secret. I viewed that as a public service, and my colleagues won a Pulitzer Prize for it. But suffice to say, there was some institutional ill will between the White House and the New York Times. But I learned quickly that it was institutional and not personal. I was a little nervous at that first press conference, the one I told you about, where I was not paying enough attention, and at least for a few moments, and talking to my father. But when the president called on me, he welcomed me. And somebody on his staff had obviously taken pains to tell him that somebody new would be there from the New York Times. And I never forgot that. And I told him, he welcomed me, and I said, "Thank you, Mr. President. I'm pleased to be here." Now, my second press conference did not go quite so smoothly. Somehow, proper protocol escaped me on live national television. The president called on me, and I said, "Hi, Mr. President." He said, "Did you say, 'Hi, Mr. President?'" So I sort of fumbled around a little bit, and I said, "Well, hello, Mr. President." He shrugged, and he said, "Either way, I thought it was a friendly greeting." I looked back at him and I said, "Well, we're a friendly newspaper." Well, he cracked up. And all the reporters were laughing. I was laughing so hard that he asked me if he should go on to the next person and come back to me later. And the entire thing was captured live, you know, on Fox News, and they replayed it that night. And it was a reminder, I think, to all of us that we need to relax with each other, that we can have our differences, that we can come at things from different ways, but that we could laugh at ourselves too. Now, that's not to say I didn't have disagreements with the White House. Toward the end of the Bush administration, I wrote a very hard-hitting story about how President Bush's policies on housing and his home ownership agenda had contributed to the mortgage meltdown. And the White House was very, very angry about this. And when the White House didn't like something reporters wrote, they would issue these documents that they called Setting the Record Straight. So that morning I got a call from Ed Gillespie, President Bush's counselor, who said to me, all he said was, "We will set the record straight." And it must have taken them all day to come up with what they were going to say, but at 4 o'clock that afternoon, a 3-page document blast email came out of the White House, "Setting the record straight." And, you know, I still have it somewhere, but I would say Ed Gillespie and I still talk to each other. Now he's on the other side. The Democrats are in the White House. And again, sort of no, you know, institutional differences, but not personal ill will. Now, covering the White House is not like covering Congress. You cannot exactly roam the hallways of the White House and collar the National Security Advisor, much less the president himself. But where you do see those people is on the road. And Holly mentioned in her introduction that I've traveled a lot. And, you know, when the president goes to a foreign country, it's really quite a scene. There is this huge traveling entourage. The trips are very grueling. The last White House trip I did, the foreign trip, was to India, South Korea, Japan, and Indonesia. And you're literally traveling in this big pack. There's no sleep. I slept, I think, maybe 3 hours a night. The web demands on us are very heavy now because we're really a 24-hour news operation. Here you are, you're staying in this hotel with all the White House staff. The president usually stays in some other hotel. They don't want him exposed to the masses of us. But you see each other at the gym and at the breakfast table, you really kind of have to learn to live with each other. And I have found in my White House years of White House coverage, you have to learn to kind of draw boundaries. You have to learn when you're a person and when you're a reporter. And this came into stark relief for me very recently. Some of you might have heard of David Axelrod, President Obama's senior advisor. There was a big going-away party for him recently in Washington, and a lot of reporters were invited, and we brought our spouses. So there I was with my husband, when out of the corner of my eye, I see the president walking in. It's at a party on Saturday night. I said to my husband, put your food down now. We were at the buffet table, and in walks Barack Obama, and there we are, and here I am. We were Egypt was in the middle of its uprising. It was sort of early. Tunisia had been in revolt, and I'm thinking, it's the president. I'm a reporter. You know, I should be asking him about Egypt, and, you know, what is he going to do? But, you know, that would have been the fastest way to just drive him away. He wasn't going to talk to me about Egypt at a party on Saturday night. So, you know, we chatted about our kids, and we talked about Rahm Emanuel's race for mayor, and he was very animated about Illinois politics, and we talked about Axelrod, and we had a lovely conversation, but I really had to learn to restrain myself. And in the end, we talked for so long that I kept thinking, doesn't he have something better to do than just to hang around here talking to me? It was useful for me, frankly, to have that kind of exposure to him, to see him in a relaxed setting. You do get a different perspective, and putting the notebook down is important as a journalist sometime. A lot of people ask me, you know, what are the presidents really like? Well, they really are kind of what you see is what you get. Obama is definitely sort of this cool, you know, detached figure, very self-contained, very smooth. President Bush was kind of the prankster, he would make jokes all the time. But one thing that did strike me about President Bush actually was how smooth talking he was in private. You know, he would always make fun of himself for mangling the English language in public, and people would say at press conferences he looked kind of like a deer in the headlights. He would trip over his own words. Well, there were a couple of occasions where I participated in off-the-record situations, off-the-record conversations with him. He would have round tables. The Times does not really like us to do off-the-record sessions with presidents, but because I was new covering the White House, they allowed me to participate, and I was very struck by how relaxed he was, how fluent in every aspect of policy. He was able to talk at length about foreign policy, domestic education policy. He went on and on about President Hu Jintao of China. He gave a complete sort of psychoanalysis of him, which I thought was fascinating because President Bush hated anybody to psychoanalyze him. But he, it was really, really interesting to me. And I came away from there. This was in 2006, and his poll numbers were really in the tank, but I came away from there seeing really a different side of him, and I could see why people would have followed him as a leader, and I could also understand better the frustration of his own aides who felt that America kind of wasn't seeing the man that they saw. Now, there are some perks to covering the White House. You do get to fly on Air Force One. We rotate through in a press pool, and I've seen some fascinating places that I would never get to see otherwise. Once we went to the Polish president's retreat on the Baltic Sea. He received President Bush there, and it was absolutely stunning, this beautiful, modern place right on the glittering Baltic. In 2008, I traveled to Kenya with Condi Rice. We took a side trip during a trip that President Bush took to Africa. She took a small plane to Nairobi, a 12-seater. I was the only reporter on board, and she was going there to try to settle out a terrible election dispute. And we flew over Mount Kilimanjaro at sunset, and it was absolutely fabulous. And so it's been an honor, I think, and a privilege for me to have had these experiences. Two of the most fun things I've done have been lunches with the first ladies at the White House. Recently, Michelle Obama hosted a round table for reporters, and we ate. It was a lunch, and we ate vegetables from the White House garden. The food was lovely. And Laura Bush also hosted such a roundtable in their last year in office, and they gave us a tour. She had a curator from the White House give the reporters a tour of some of the private areas, including the recently renovated Lincoln bedroom, which has this incredible rosewood bed that was purchased by Mary Todd Lincoln. That's got a beautiful gold fringe, an elaborate crown, and there's a copy of the Gettysburg Address in there, hand-copied by Lincoln. It's the only one in existence, I think, that is signed and dated and titled by Lincoln. They took us into the room where the elder Bushes like to stay. It's called the Queen's Room, and I was struck to find there was a TV in there. It was this beautiful room, but apparently the elder Bushes like to watch TV when they came to visit their son. And adjacent to that room is this beautiful sitting room that is still in the decor that Jackie Kennedy put there. And I'm only sorry that ordinary Americans can't get to see that, because for me it was just such a privilege and an opportunity to do that. If there's an upside to covering the White House, it's that you're a witness to history. But if there is a downside, besides the grueling hours, it's getting caught in the emotional and very vitriolic discourse that our country is in. Sometimes I have find it really overwhelming, frankly. I have seen President Obama referred to by the use of the N-word in my email. One correspondent called him a Mississippi porch monkey. I'll never forget that. My readers would refer to President Bush as a liar or a murderer or worse. I cannot tell you how many times, if I ever wrote that he was reading a book, people would write in and say, "Oh, we know the president doesn't read." Well, the president does read. You know, you might not like him, but he actually does read books. And my readers would turn their vitriol against me, and it has been painful at times. I always try to read my email, but when people are saying, likening you to someone who is performing sexual acts on a White House aide, or saying it would have been better if you had gone back to the Nazi ovens, you know, maybe that might hurt a little bit. Now, part of this, I think, is the internet era. People say things over the internet that they would never say in person. But I think that also, and sometimes I'll write back, I'll say to people, you know, you should be ashamed, or your mother should wash your mouth out with soap, or do you kiss your mother with that mouth? You know? Or sometimes, actually my best one, I didn't come up with this, someone gave this to me, is to write, "Dear sir, you might be interested in knowing that someone with the most foul mouth has obviously hacked his way into your computer and is sending out vile emails under your name." But I also think the problem is not just the internet. It's that we as a society haven't really learned the lessons that I learned here in Charlottesville, that we need to find a way to coexist, that we need to tolerate one another, that we need to be able to see things from another person's point of view, that we can have political disagreements, but we can be cordial. We're in a time when our country is facing grave challenges. Our military is committed now on three fronts. The White House announced today that President Obama will be giving an address on Monday to talk about the progress in Libya. We face crushing deficits and debt if we don't tackle Medicare and Social Security in the coming years. We'll be in trouble. We're in the thick of a philosophical battle about the size and scope of government. And all these things and problems require a coming together. And I think all of us maybe could use a little cross-cultural pollination of the sort that I got here. Sometimes I wish every American could have the advice that I got from my guidance counselor. Go somewhere else. Live with people who aren't like you. It might do us all a lot of good. And I'll leave you with just a quick story to make that point, kind of a sad story in my view. A couple of years ago, I took my older daughter, Olivia, to the White House Christmas party. It's very formal. You go there, and the White House is beautiful. It's decorated. When you're a reporter, you get to bring one guest. So I've brought both my children and my husband in various years. And you stand in a receiving line, and you are introduced formally to the president. A military aide announces you, and it's really a photo line. And so they would announce, you know, Ms. Cheryl Stolberg of the New York Times and her daughter, Olivia Robinson. It was President Bush's last year in office, and we went up to him, and I introduced Olivia, and I said that she had given 10% of the money that she had been given as gifts for her bat mitzvah to Malaria No More, which was a charity that he established as part of his Africa policy to eradicate malaria. And he looked at her, and he leaned over, and he gave her a kiss on the cheek. And he said, "Thank you. That's for all the babies that you've saved." And I told that story to a friend of mine later from Boston, and she recoiled. She said, "I don't see how you let your child get within 10 feet of that man. don't you think his inhumanity would be contagious? And I was very shocked and saddened by that, and I told her what I have always told my daughters, that you can disagree with the policies, but you respect the office of the president. And on that note, I think I've talked long enough, and we can take some questions. I'll be happy to take your questions on anything. Oh, Holly did say that I would say what I'm doing now. I've just taken a new assignment, literally 2 weeks old, where I'm writing features and profiles of sort of bringing to life people in Washington, and I'm absolutely thrilled by it. I'm going to have a lot more freedom and flexibility and to do some more creative work and not so much the daily grind. And after 5 years of the White House, I'm really ready for a break, so... But I'm happy to take anybody's question on anything, just about. Yes?
I teach English as a second language. I'm 35. I'm really touched by what you say. I tell all my friends, well educated, that they really make some really ethnic, racial, religious, negative comments sometimes. And I can tell that I'm not as eloquent, but
We're not all so, but there is an element of that in our society that I think we all recognize. Yes? Many people ask this question, and I have to say, it is really not an issue for me. I've been a journalist for almost 30 years. I have really learned to see both sides of the story. This makes my family crazy, because whenever my mother is having a fight with her sister, I'll say, well, but you know, you need to really see this from her perspective. And it really isn't an issue, and I know people don't believe that. I will say that reporters come at stories through a prism, through the prism of their own experiences. But first of all, I would never work in Washington again if I wrote things in, say, a biased way or in a way that reflected one political viewpoint, right? Part of my job is maintaining good relationships with Republicans and Democrats. A really important part is seeing both sides of the story, is understanding both sides of the issue, is writing in sort of a neutral way. And I know that, and it's hard for people to understand it. When I took the White House job, I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, in Bethesda. It's a very liberal area. People would say to me, oh, how could you do that job? You have to be around that guy, you know, president. And I would say, you know what? It's really interesting. He's the president. He's making decisions that affect the, you know, the course of our country. This is history in the making. It's my job to write about that. It is not my job to impose my political views. It's my job to be skeptical of his policies, and it is now my job to be skeptical of President Obama's policies. So I'm an equal opportunity critic. And I always know that I'm doing okay when I get email from the left and the right on the same story, and they're both hollering at me. And I cannot. Sometimes what I do is I will send them the emails. I'll say, well, you guys both can't be right. Why don't you talk to each other? And what I learned is that people read stories through the prism of their own experience. So someone may read something and think that I'm being critical of the president, and someone else may read the same story and find things in it that they see are admiring. But after you've done it for a while, you know, you just become a professional. It's part of our ethic to be neutral and objective, and but also at the same time to recognize that I do bring my own life experiences. I'm not a robot or a machine, and I'm not, you know, That it wouldn't be very interesting, frankly, to read a story written by a robot or a machine. I hope we don't get there. Let's see, there's a lot of questions. You had your hand up, so let's start here in the second row, and then in the back, and then over here.
Just to build on that question, I'm a little dismayed and concerned about particularly, you know, broadcast news. Seems to be so pointed and vitriolic, as you say, and trying to, it's very biased and very emotional, and I'm just really concerned that the Walter Cronkite era is so far behind us now, and I, there are certain news programs I simply won't watch because I find it so upsetting. I want that unbiased news. I want to hear it presented in a way that's factual and has lots of information that I can reflect on, but that's not what the trend that I'm seeing, and it concerns me. I just wanted to hear your thoughts.
I have to say,
that.
I'm concerned about that, too, but what concerns me more is not that there are news outlets like, let's say, Fox or MSNBC with a certain point of view, but almost more that people are drawn to watching news outlets with their own point of view, right? So conservatives watch Fox, and they get reinforced by what they hear there, and liberals watch MSNBC. I wish it were the other way around, or I wish everybody would watch both. But more and more in our society, because there are so many outlets for news, there are so many ways of getting information, and many of them with political spin, that people read what they tend to agree with, and I think that reinforces our divisions. I'm all for kind of a variety of news and information and, you know, filling the public sphere. I do think that I think neutral reporting is important. It's important to have unbiased sources. I think people generally recognize, you know, when their news source does come with a bias. I just, as I said, wish people would get information or at least listen to outlets that come from an opposing point of view. You had a question in the back. You know, I don't know, honestly, who does that. We have a whole web operation. It's very integrated with our news operation. I work in Washington, and the headquarters is up in New York. I don't know that they always monitor those comments that well, frankly. I think it can be kind of overwhelming. But I am a fan of monitoring our comments. I don't think that we have an obligation on our website to just let anybody say anything. I think our discourse should be civil, and that we should expect that. So I believe in that. But I mean, I don't know exactly who does it. It's probably a team of people, I would think. It's a lot of work. You had one, and then let's go over it. We'll take you on. I'll get to you in a second. Go ahead.
The New York Times has had the reputation of being a real male bastion. What has your experience been like at the Times?
It does have a reputation of being a male bastion. It's still, in the Washington Bureau, a lot more men than women. But I don't feel isolated, really. In fact, our White House team was all women, myself, Jackie Combs, and Helene Cooper, until I left, and now Mark Landler has replaced me. But we still are probably, in our bureau, probably three-quarters men. My colleagues are cordial. They're lovely people. The New York Times has a reputation, or it used to, as kind of like a backstabbing place. We're really a family. So I don't feel out of place as a woman or put upon, really, in any way. I'm not the first woman to cover the White House. I haven't been a trailblazer in any way. Many people have come before me. So I think it's a comfortable environment for me. And over here?
I was a reporter and editor and manager at the University Journal.
I remember your name, actually.
Here.
But you're a lot younger than I am, but I recognized your name. And yes, you should admit it to me.
Okay. Well, then I will proudly admit that I was a reporter, editor, and manager at the University Journal when I was here. And I actually worked a year at the Daily Progress, too. And then found myself, you know, wanting to go into journalism and completely, I mean, couldn't find a thing. Nobody, no place I went was hiring someone without a journalism degree, which was not offered here.
Yeah.
But I thought my experience would make up for that. How did you break in? How did you?
Well, I actually noticed you before because I thought your name looked familiar to me, and I think you graduated in 93 or so. Is that right?
I did. Can you see?
See, I'm a trained observer. No, I just read it. I read your name tag earlier. I'm sorry. I'm. This is true story. So how did I break? I mean, it's possible. I graduated 10 years ahead of you. It's very possible that the climate was different. I don't have a journalism degree. I just wrote stories, and I had an internship when I was at the Cavalier Daily, at the Roanoke Times and World News, and then I had another internship in Providence, Rhode Island, and you know, I just worked really hard and got lucky, frankly. And you know, maybe in that intervening decade, it just became harder. So, anybody else?
I was just going to say, I graduated in 83 also, and I did internship at the TV station and radio stations here. That was the way of getting a job.
Yeah, internships were. You know who else graduated in 83? Does anybody remember? We used to call her Sally James, but Sarah James. Yeah, she was just, so gung-ho. I just remember her, you know, working on the, you know, being a TV reporter here, you know, when we were students. And she did great, and she's now living in Australia. She's written a book, and we served on a panel here together a couple of years ago. But how about 1, 2, 3? Go ahead. I do use social media to discover information. I'm probably not as reliant on it as some other people, but, you know, when you cover the White House now, you have to follow Twitter because the press secretary will sometimes tweet things. I use Facebook to find people. So I was writing some story. I think I was actually writing about Chelsea Clinton's wedding. I was writing a fun story for the Styles section. And I used Facebook to find some of her friends. When I was covering the Elena Kagan confirmation hearings, I wrote a lot about her. I used Twitter too, I have written a lot about gay rights issues also, so I would use Twitter to monitor stuff that was going through on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, just to sort of see what was out there. Social media is changing our business very dramatically. The web has changed our business incredibly since I took over. First of all, we are, as I said, a 24-hour news operation now. The emphasis on getting things first and speed and getting stuff up there quickly is incredible and sometimes upsetting to me, because when you're the New York Times, you want to write something in an analytic way. You don't just want to be a wire service, and you find, especially as the White House correspondent, you're doing both. So when the president gives the State of the Union address, you're literally slapping something up there really fast for the web that reads kind of like an AP story. The president said this, and then you're rewriting for the paper, trying to infuse it with some analysis. This is what he meant. This is the political context, etc. So the demands are very, very great. And, you know, it seems like things are always popping. And that's frankly one reason why I wanted to stop doing the White House beat and just be able to write stories that would allow me a little bit more time, not much, frankly, but at least a little more to just reflect. We had some others over here. We'll just go on in a row here. The gentleman right here. Mm-hmm.
This is a little difficult to put together as a question, but how do you react when people accuse the New York Times or an organization like the Washington Post, as has been done for many years, of bias, usually accused of left-wing bias?
Right, right.
NPR and PBS also, which puzzles me when I look at the editorial pages. I see Maureen Dowd and Don Friedman, fairly liberal. I see David Brooks, Ross Douthat, fairly conservative.
Right.
The Washington Post has similar things, and NPR is always putting people on both sides of the issues. And then you have people say, oh, you know, they're all left-wing bias. How do you answer that?
I try to explain that we do have a division between our news and our editorial, that our editorial page is liberal. It is. That is the view of our editorial page. But I don't deal with those people. That is not my job, and I try to draw them out and say, what do you see in the news pages that strikes you as liberal? And often people really can't, you know, they just have this sort of general sense that we're a liberal outlet. But we do get accused of that, and frankly, it can make life difficult as a reporter. When I was covering Congress, I would travel the country a lot writing about elections, and I'd spend a lot of time in red states. And a lot of times you were greeted, you know, not very happily as a when you were a reporter from the New York Times. Sometimes I almost felt like I was on like a one-person mission to just change views, and that literally just by talking to people, by writing fair stories, by being honest and accurate, I was doing all that I could do that was in sort of in within my purview. But you do hear that, and you hear people say in the Wall Street Journal's conservative. Well, yes, the Wall Street Journal's editorial page is conservative, but their news pages are pretty straightforward, just like ours are. So I just try to explain that. But we do get those accusations. And then, frankly, you know, some things in our history haven't helped us. I'm sure you remember the Jason Blair incident. You know, horrible, 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 the most awful thing that we ever went through, I think, in my time at the newspaper. It's not good when stuff like that happens, and we had to overcome that. That was a very difficult time for us. I do think we've put that past us, but you used to hear people say, oh, well, you work for that. You know, are you going to make this up? You know, it was very painful. Yes? Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely correct. I think it's always going to be more complicated and more more fraught because as science advances, right, we learn new things. So, 30 years ago, we learned how to do a test tube baby. Well, now, we can have pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. In fact, that's old. That's 10 years out of date, where you can go to the doctor and you can diagnose, you can find out if your baby is carrying a disease. Well, you could also select for sex. If how do you deal with that? And I'm dating myself here because I haven't covered those issues in about a decade. But yes, I do think that with the march of progress, and also, frankly, limits in funding, we advance. We have new technologies. Who's going to get these technologies? Who's going to get an artificial heart if we can create one? Should Dick Cheney have one? He's 70-some years old. He probably has the money to buy one. All of these things, we're bumping up against each other. Are the march of science and the limitation of our funding it's on a collision course. So, yes, I do. Short answer is yes. I don't feel schooled enough to talk about what's happening currently, though. Someone else over there? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Newspapers are being purchased less and less. Printed matter for newspapers is less and less. And what is being said is, oh, they're taking the newspapers online. Are the generations following ours, I'm class of 74 here, are they really reading newspapers online, or are they taking shortcuts? Is anybody who's reading the depth?
Olivia, who's reading?
Thank you.
I think that's about right. I think we're in an information society, you know, right? When I was a kid, we thought we were going to get the space age, right? We thought we were going to be zipping around like the Jetsons. What we got was the information age. And I do think that young people are consumers of news. I'm not worried about the disappearance of the physical paper so long as we can generate enough revenue to sustain the kind of news gathering operation that we have, which is very expensive. You know, I would note that four of my colleagues were held captive in Libya recently. My admiration for them is unending. It costs a lot of money to send reporters out all over the world to have the kind of protection that they that many of them need. When our colleagues were covering the Iraq war, you know, we needed armored vehicles, all kinds of things that you can't imagine. It is expensive to run this kind of news gathering operation. So my feeling is, as long as, you know, if we can figure out a way to generate the revenue to support it, then we're all okay. Because I do think that as a society, we're interested in information. And there is a, maybe I'm optimistic, but I do feel that there's a market for it. Am I getting the wrap it up sign here? Could be. One more question? Or a couple more? How about these two over here? Why don't you go ahead first? I don't want to get too much into the Helen Thomas controversy. I just might take a little bit issue with the notion that she reigned supreme at that point. I would just set the record straight from a journalistic perspective. She had been a columnist, and many people felt that she didn't belong as an opinion columnist with a seat in the White House press room. And I subscribed to that view. And I think that what happened with her bears that out. So we'll leave that as it may. My colleagues in the White House Press Corps were fabulous. And it is truly, there's a lot of camaraderie, and it's a wonderful group to work with. You know, when you're covering the White House, it is very hard and it's very grueling, and you pretty much all have access to the same information, unless you're really developing some sort of enterprise story. But when you're doing sort of the basic work of covering the White House, which involves the president's activities and policy announcements, et cetera, you know, you're not cultivating anything unique. And I have found all my colleagues across platforms, TV, radio, print, to really be the most wonderful and supportive bunch. We like each other. We help each other. It's hard enough as it is without, you know, without being competitive. And we're thrown together in this very intense environment. So I was welcomed there. And I miss them, actually. Yes?
I get the privilege of the last question because I was asked to bring the mic down after this. Okay. This is actually a softball question, but it's sort of technical. You've made a good distinction between the editorial pages and the news pages and what's covered in your story. Isn't there a bit of frustration sometimes about the headline writers, the captions and the subcaptions, which seem to give a spin to stories, whereas when you get into the story itself, you wrote the story, but you didn't get to write the editorial.
That's exactly right. I don't write the headlines. Sometimes I'll look at the headlines. If it's a story that I feel is particularly sensitive or a headline could go either way, I will ask to see what the headline is. I don't know that they necessarily give a spin to the headlines, but there is sometimes a frustration. Are you thinking of something in particular?
Sometimes they like to be cute and
yeah.
try to play with something, and sometimes it doesn't quite come off right.
Yeah. I'll tell you what a headline that really, really bothered me. I mentioned before that I wrote about Chelsea Clinton's wedding. I tend to do these kind of fun style stories. I also wrote about Jenna Bush's wedding. And the headline was the hoedown in Crawford. I was so mad. I hope none of my editors or editors in New York are listening to this, because I just thought that was the most, it was just a bunch of Upper West Side liberal bias. It was a lovely wedding. She got married on a ranch, her parents' ranch. It's a beautiful ranch with wildflowers, and the landscape is incredible. And That one really did tick me off. I probably shouldn't have fessed it up here, so let's keep it, you know, among ourselves. But I guess we'll end on that note. Thank you.